Hey, Twisted History listeners, you can find us every Wednesday night on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Here is a bulletin from Kennedy's motorcade.
7-6. We have main engine start.
Gutted shells of buildings, flames raging out of control.
The devastation is so widespread.
It follows a security alert earlier this morning.
It is July 20th, 1969.
Breaking news, major corruption crackdown going down.
Time to make up your mind about people as never.
Sonny, there's only one word to describe what's happening, and that is panic.
A description on one wire service, master criminal.
Hey everybody, welcome on back. It's the Twisted History Podcast brought to you by Barstool Sports. My name is Large. My given name is Mike McCarthy. I'm just going to put that out there right now. I don't often tell people, but my real name is Mike McCarthy. I'm pretty proud of it.
How long have I known you? 3 years? I don't think you've ever said your
full name. No, never put my full name out there. I'm joined here today by Ken Jack.
Given name Jack Kennedy, if you want.
And that's
that
why
too.
I'm telling you right now, because right now this podcast is Jack Kennedy and Mike McCarthy.
That's too
this,
Irish.
This should be like the Twisted History of Whiskey.
Yeah.
Or, right? You know, something like that.
Political corruption.
Yeah.
Or we should have done Kennedy's. We've always been wanting
to. Oh, God, yeah.
And then we have John Kelly on the ones and twos.
Yeah, seriously.
So this is as shanty of a podcast as you're going to find. We're doing the Twisted History of Genghis Khan. We haven't done single person episodes. Probably won't be a long one, but I think we did Al Capone with Eddie, and we went on so many different tangents because Al Capone obviously, you know, leads to so many mob things. We did Larry Flint, and I did that with Kate. And then Larry Flint, we did a couple of tangents too because like Lisa Ann came on.
Oh, yeah.
Did like
yeah.
an interstitial about how much she loved Larry Flint. Rest in peace. Mm-hmm. We did Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy, you know, obviously was something. That was a short one. That was when we were very, when we just started. I think it was like our fourth or fifth podcast. I think we're up to like 70 something now. So very few times do we just, we did Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor was a single one that we did. He was awesome. You know, son of a whore and his grandmother was a pimp and stabbed somebody, all that kind of shit. Richard Pryor was awesome. Then he used to put cocaine on his dick before he banged Pam Grier. We'll throw that out there in the morning.
Who else did he bang? He banged actor.
Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
According gorgeous. To Spike, not Spike Jones.
Yeah. That was the Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones.
Yeah, yeah. So we haven't done too many. So out of all those episodes that we've done, we haven't done too many single person episodes. We're going to do one for Genghis Khan. I thought I was going to go and break out and do like, you know, Attila the Hun and Gilgamesh and shit like that with it. But Genghis Khan's the man. He's enough, I think. So I'm not going to do anything more than him, I think, unless it kind of leads to something, which makes sense. But how are you, buddy? How's everything?
I'm doing good. I'm excited for this. Like very few people in history have altered the course of history more than Genghis Khan. And I'm excited to talk about him.
Alexander the Great, Napoleon.
And none of them had an empire even close to the same size, which is crazy.
Not even fucking close. So, and I'm going to try and tail off some of my cursing this week. I've been cursing a lot. And as I listen back to it, I sound a little ignorant. Like when I get mad, if it's like a Karl Malone type thing, Karl Malone raped 13-year-old
girl. Oh, I'm aware.
Yeah, yeah. So if he gets my Irish up a little bit, I'll curse. But otherwise, if it's just casual, if you guys want to say language or something, I'm trying to pay attention to it. It's just a new me. Full names, no cursing. Here we go, douchebags. Genghis Khan is the first great Khan, Wrath of Khan. Khan means emperor. He was the Khan of the Mongol Empire. He ruled from 1206 to 1227. So he came after Attila the Hun, and then the Gilgamesh story was like Sumerian. It was like
that's like BC. Well,
like 3,000 years before either of these guys were around. The Mongol Empire became the largest contiguous empire in history not too soon after his death. At one point, covering nearly 18% of the globe. I say contiguous because I have to make that distinction. And this was one that surprised me, even though I think I kind of knew it.
The Brits?
I just didn't know. And so if you're going to look at – so contiguous means that all the borders touch. They share a border, or at least this empire, every part of it touches each other inappropriately at some place.
It's one big blob.
One landmass, yeah. And so as far as a contiguous empire, it's not the Holy Roman Empire. It's not anything – it's the Mongol Empire was the biggest. It covered 18% of the globe, right? And I make the distinction of contiguous versus non because the British Empire is number one with a bullet for having a grasp on the globe, but it's spread out all over the place.
Yeah. They had giant chunks of land in like Africa, all over South America, in some sections, like in the Caribbean, like everywhere you could, and like even like in the Orient and fucking India, all of these giant places, which you didn't really, I think, cognizantly realize, like they were had governance over, even if it wasn't like some, it didn't seem as if it was like an empire in the same sense as like the Genghis Khan's or like the fucking Kublai Khan's or Alexander's.
Right.
It's still the same thing because it's just more bureaucratic.
But I also was wondering because when I look at like empires and you say, what's the biggest empire in the history of the world? And if I was to say, oh, the Mongol Empire in, so Genghis Khan, I said, died in 1227. Mm-hmm. The biggest his empire got was probably, say, 20 years after his death. So we're looking at the mid-1200s. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That's like empire time for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The British Empire peaked 1920. So we're looking at 1920 and it's still that big. This isn't like Crusades England, where they're kind of ravishing across, sticking a flag in India, that's mine. That's not like one of these bullshit type things. The British Empire, I won't speak too long about it, but by 1913, the British Empire held sway over 412 million people, which was 23% of the world population at the time. That's staggering. So the British Empire was in control of 23% of the world at one time. By 1920, it's 100 years ago, but as far as history goes, that's pretty recent. It covered 13.7 million square miles, or 24% of the Earth's total land area. So 23% of the population, 24% of the land area.
So the reason that peak in 1918 or 1920 is because after World War One, the reparations, they had to give all of that back, essentially, to, or not back, just give it to the British and the French. So a lot of those colonies got lost by Germany, especially in Africa, and those all went to then mostly Great Britain.
Yeah, and I would think that, to your point, too, like they owned most of America at one point, mm-hmm. and that doesn't count, right? Like in 1920. So all this shit that had happened in and around World War One and World War Two is what ended the British empire.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And they had so many people who took up arms during both those wars that when those wars had come to a close, a lot of them then became like free states, almost like they just sort of walked away from the empire. And Britain wasn't motivated to kind of keep it, so they just kind of let the empire dissolve. Yeah. They just kind of let it dissolve. So the greatest empire in the world was the British Empire, non-contiguous. Like I said, it didn't touch each other all the way around. But, so it took me a while to realize that. But back to Khan. So it's actually pronounced Genghis. And as I'm watching some of these, like, documentaries and stuff, I don't know. You were saying Genghis. I'm not doing it.
Here's the thing, I think. So I was a history major in college.
Yeah.
And none of the professors there would call him Genghis. They would call him Genghis.
Right.
So I think it's more a worldly problem. And I think in the West, I think it's cool for us to just say Genghis Khan.
Okay, good. So I'm staying with it. In Mongolia, the G is always soft.
Yeah.
Apparently. But we're not in Mongolia.
I'm going to be honest. I thought you were really sleepy this morning just saying it wrong. I was like, large right off the top, just saying it wrong.
No, not at all. So Genghis Khan is, I think, how it's preferred. Or Genghis Khan is how it's preferred. And if you watch some of these little kind of videos, which I wind up doing every week. Before we do this thing, I always watch like one of those infographics.
Mm-hmm.
I think those things are so good if you just want to get like a little, I don't know, boost on what the hell you're talking about. I almost said the F word there. And every one of them, all the hardos go, Genghis, I'm not doing it. One of the things I am going to apologize for, John, this is kind of an addendum. Man, did I say New Orleans a lot last week or 2 weeks ago. Instead of New Orleans,
I thought we were going to leave that in the past.
No, I was told New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. I kept saying New Orleans. And then I kept complaining about how bad the roads and the infrastructure are down in New Orleans. So some guy had hit me, and apparently there's a saying. Every time somebody pronounces it New Orleans, they get a new pothole. So I screwed them last week, and I apologize to people down in New Orleans. But it is New Orleans, not New Orleans. It pisses people off, so I'll
maybe
apologize.
You cursed, Mincy.
Yeah. True. Oh, my
you
God.
You never know.
A little inside Barstool there, sorry.
Holy cow. That is a monumental type thing. It's good. I mean, it's the only reason I'm paying attention to College World Series. Our good friend Ben Mintz, who was on 2 weeks ago with the Twisted History of New Orleans, has been on an absolute tear. Not being able to pick a single College World Series game.
Nothing correct.
Holy cow.
I'll tell you what. Terrible. He bet on the Suns last night, covered the spread, and I've never been more scared of anything in my entire life.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Ken Jack's huge Suns fan, by the way. Congratulations. Back to Khan again. His birth name is actually Temujin, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right. There are a ton of Mongolian words that are going to be in this episode. I don't care. I'm going to try and get through them all. But Temujin is how I'm going to pronounce his name. That's the original one. And literally, Temujin means blacksmith. He's said to be born somewhere around 1162 in Delun Bulldog on the banks of the Onon River. I can't imagine I got Temujin, Delun Bulldog, or perhaps even the Onon River.
Delun Bulldog. Bulldog? Bulldog? B-O-L-D-O-G. That's Bulldog? Bulldog sounds nicer.
Bulldog, yeah. So he's born on the banks. Yeah, Delun Bulldog on the banks of the Onon River. I'll get it. The name Genghis Khan wasn't given to him until 1206. I'm going to say the year 1206 multiple times, especially before we go to our first ad. 1206, when he was about 44 years old. Genghis means stern or fierce, and Khan, as I mentioned above, means ruler or king. Some people think that Genghis has a nautical definition, meaning like ocean-wide, and that this guy's empire had stretched from ocean to ocean. But I think the traditional meaning of Genghis is stern or fierce. So stern or fierce, ruler or king, makes sense. That's Genghis Khan. And the name was bestowed upon him during his coronation as the king of all Mongols. And this is where I'm going to start to do a bunch of names. His father's name was Yasuji. You think that's it? Yasuji?
Yeah, I think they do hard G's a lot in these names. And this is based off of like one thing only. And
I can't go hard G because they want me to go
Genghis.
Yeah, so I got to go G, right? I made a decision to not go Yasugi.
So there's a show that Netflix made a while back called Marco Polo.
Yeah.
Where in that show, it was all about Kublai Khan. But in that show, they pronounced certain names like Ogaday and other names like that. And
a lot
of them had harder Gs. So that's my only frame of reference for this because, again, in college, none of the professors, I think, are pronouncing anything right. So.
I'm going hard G. It's Yasugi then. So his father's name was Yasugi. He was a chieftain of the Borjigin clan, which was the ruling class of Mongol tribes. So there's always been Mongols around, but it was just one of many tribes back in the day in and around the steppes of Russia, Asia, all around there. So the Mongols was one of more than a dozen tribes. His mother's name was Holun, and she was kidnapped by his dad, Yasugi, on the way back from her own wedding, which is pretty pimp. Yasugi abducted Holun because of her beauty and her physical indications of fertility. What's a physical indication of fertility? John, go.
Being large belly. Being
large belly is one of them. Mm-hmm. That's me.
Childbearing hips of some sort.
Wide hips and good teeth. I think I have great teeth. I have wide hips. I think, and a nice strong belly. I think that I'm seem as fertile as anything.
And you're tall, too. You're probably taller than any Mongol who's ever existed during that time.
Could be one of the tallest Mongols that ever lived. Temujin was born clutching a blood clot in his right hand. They mention this on every 10 facts you didn't know about Genghis Khan. And that's one of those things that I go to all the time, too. Here's an account from his birth. Gently but nervously, his young mother pried back his fingers one by one to find a large black blood clot the size of a knuckle bone. From somewhere in his mother's warm womb, this boy had grasped the blood clot and brought it with him from that world into this one. A blood clot the size of a knuckle bone grosses me out. I never heard of such thing, but apparently being born while clutching a blood clot is an omen that's believed to be a sign of greatness and strength.
I feel like if in those points in history, the mortality rate during childbirth was so low that if a kid ripped a blood clot out of your womb, you probably would have died.
I didn't even know. Like, I gotta be honest with you, I didn't Google it or anything like that, but I didn't even know what a blood clot looks like. Like, I'm assuming it's just.
I'm imagining like a red stone, basically.
Yeah, or something maybe not as hard. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, like maybe like with the kids, the slime the kids are playing with. No, I just don't know. But anyway, he had a blood clot, and it was an omen that he was going to be a big time ruler. When he was 9 years old, his father, Yasugi, delivered him to who was going to be his first wife. It was a 10-year-old girl named Borte. I think she has an accent on the E. And he was hoping to create alliance between her people, the Kongarat, and the Mongols. A lot of words. So 9-year-old Genghis, who's not Genghis yet, is delivered to 10-year-old Borte, hoping to create alliance between her people and Yasugi's people, the Mongols. After dropping him off with Borte's family, Yasugi was then traveling back to his village when he stopped at a feast. And the feast was actually being held by a group of his enemies called the Tatars. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying that one. T-A-T-A-R-S.
Not like tartar sauce?
I'm too into tartar sauce. I'm going the other way. I like to call them taters, but it's the Tatars. So they're holding this festival. They invite Yasugi in, and they wind up poisoning him. So he's dead. So now young Genghis, young Temujin, finds out that his dad was murdered by the Tatars. He was poisoned. So he leaves Borte immediately before they get married and returns home to claim his title as the leader of the Mongols to take over his dad's job. When he gets home, the Mongols already appointed a new leader. They kind of branched off and appointed two leaders, but they left young Temujin out of the mix. Not only did they do that, they cast out his whole family. They expelled 9-year-old Temujin and his family and left his mother, Holin, to raise her 7 children alone and now in near poverty on the steppes. And we're going to say steppes a lot. Steppes are traditionally just the description of a swath of land that no mountains, just kind of plains.
Flat.
Yeah, there's typically a river that runs through it. All the trees within the steppes are located in and around the river, so you don't have a lot. There's no natural defenses. There's no nothing. So people who live on the steppes are not people that go around caves and all that kind of stuff. It's just a geographic distinction.
And they're up on the plateau, too, so you get a little bit more elevation. And, yeah, it's interesting. And the way that the nomads would all work in the Mongol Empire, like they would have these huts and obviously move around from place to place to find whatever has the most natural resources. They would burn like shit to basically keep themselves warm.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have like these really like intricate sort of huts to make sure that like essentially your whole house doesn't smell like shit and you can cook with it. You can do all these things because you don't have the wood to make a house. You don't have the wood to make a fire. You don't have like really any of this.
Oh, you meant actual shit.
Like, oh, real shit.
I thought he meant like shit laying
dung.
Around.
No, like actual dung from the animals that they would
eat. He's not cursing.
Yeah.
So no, we're talking about actual dung.
I thought he meant just like miscellaneous things in the hut.
Just the crap they have. Yeah, I just burned my dresser today. Yeah.
That's kind of what I thought you meant.
Old baseball cards. But the step that we're talking about, or steps that we're talking about, stretch for thousands of miles between the Pacific, basically bordering China and Russia, all the way out into Europe,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it was just that sort of type of flat land all the way through. So at the time that his family is cast off, Temujin has 3 brothers. Their names are Hasar, Hashun, and Temuge. He's got 1 sister whose name is Temulin, and has 2 half-brothers named Begtar and Belgute. I only mention that because I want you to remember Begtar. Begtar's the only one to remember. But he had 7 children altogether, Holin. 5 of the 7 were her kids, and 2 of them were bastards that she was raising of her dead husbands, all right? Begtar was one of those bastards. We did the Twisted History of Bastards last week, and I love saying that word. So for the next several years, the family lived in poverty, surviving mostly on wild fruits, ox carcasses, because on the steppes you'd have like, you know, herds of oxen. They survived on marmots, which I had to look up again. I always thought a marmot was a monkey, but it's actually a large squirrel.
I think
squirrel.
It's like a marmoset.
A marmoset's what I was thinking. Thank you, sir. So marmots, M-A-R-M-O-T-S, are like large ground squirrels and other small game they killed, right? So now Temujin's older half-brother, Begtar, decides to flex a little bit. And he began to exercise power as the eldest male in the family and declared his right to take over as head of the family to replace his dead father. Not only was he going to take over as head of the family, he was also going to have the right to claim his stepmother, Holun. which is Genghis's mom.
I saw that episode
mom.
On Pornhub before.
Yeah, that was awesome. And so he was going to claim his stepmom as his wife. Temujin, later on to be Genghis, invited this guy, Bektar, then to go hunting. Him and his natural brother, Kassar, invited Bektar to go hunting, and they killed Bektar on the hunting trip. Mm-hmm. Problem solved. They said the hunting trip where he killed his brother had something to do with his brother's trying to claim his mom, and also the fact that his brother was hoarding food. Mm. So whichever storyline you think is sexier, I personally think the one where he's trying to steal Genghis's mom.
Yeah, it's a common theme, too, I think, when you look at Mongol history, because that happened to Kublai as well. After Kublai had already consolidated power, his own brother, which was, I'm going to double check so I don't get it wrong, I don't even have it. So he basically started this thing called the Toloid Civil War, where the Mongols were fighting against Kublai, because Kublai was more essentially adapting into Chinese culture,
right?
And his full blood younger brother wanted them to retain Mongol identity and
right.
be or like that whole like nomadic culture and all mm-hmm. of that. So he rose his own like little fjord sort of thing, and he fought against Kublai. Kublai had just destroyed them,
right. So. And Kublai is a guy that I don't get to. So Kublai Khan is Genghis Khan's grandson. For people, I'm not jumping ahead or anything, but just so you know, he's Genghis Khan's grandson. After Kublai Khan had died, things kind of went to pot for the Mongol Empire. And a lot of other things came into play around that time. I'll get into that towards the end on how the Mongol Empire would end. Mm-hmm. But he's a fascinating dude. I wish I spent a little more time on him. He's boys with Marco Polo.
Yep, was boys with Marco Polo. The Pope attempted to be boys with him. The French tried to make an alliance with him to fight against, I'm not sure, I think Venetians or something. Like
right.
They all, there's a very like expansive history. Like as much as Genghis Khan like influenced so many events, like Kublai was more of like a diplomat than Genghis was. And like he really like tried to influence world events and like adapt other cultures into his own so that everything like flowed smoother.
And it seemed like he was China-centric, right? Because like as a Mongol Khan, he was, I think, considered maybe China's first emperor.
Yeah.
Something like there's some distinction that he has within the dynasties. We don't want to talk about too much about dynasties, you know, on this one because it, because Genghis wiped most of them out.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there was a resurgence of it around Kublai's thing. Yeah, maybe I'll do a whole thing on him. Who the fuck knows?
Yeah, he destroyed a lot of Chinese dynasties. I think the last emperor that he killed was like 9 years old, and
right.
they were chasing him all the way through China to the edge of like the Pacific. And whoever is the caretaker of this like 9-year-old emperor just jumped off the cliff with him. He's like,
oh,
I'm
really?
Not letting the Mongols touch you.
Yeah.
So they just jumped straight off this massive cliff onto the rocks.
He also destroyed a lot of vaginas. Like
yes.
we talk about Genghis Khan's ability to procreate and stuff like that, and then you look at his descendants, Kublai Khan had one of the biggest harems in the history of the world. I'll get into that. So
yeah.
I'm going to get into the sex thing with Genghis and his family at some point. We're going to do a little history, then we're going to do the warring stuff, then we'll do the sex, then we'll do the death. I mean, that's kind of the way that...
Let's do it.
That's how my life has been,
yes.
right?
Same
history,
here.
War, sex,
right?
and death. All right, so I'm still at a point where I'm calling him Temujin. He's not yet officially become a Khan. His half-brother is dead. The guy with aspirations is dead. The family is pulling itself out of poverty. And Temujin then reunites, and he's about to marry Borte. They get back together. I think this is a couple of years later, so let's say he's 11 and she's 12 or 13. But then Borte was kidnapped and possibly raped because she was pregnant with a kid that may or may not have been Genghis's when they rescued her 8 months later. The kid's was a son. He was named Jochi, who Temujin and Borte raised as their own, and the couple had at least another 9 children together. Not a huge number. The McEnany's had 9. They lived around the corner from me in Brooklyn. But Temujin and Borte had 9 children together. Genghis Khan had hundreds of children, but that's what him and his original wife. And those children were the ones that were considered heirs to his throne. Every other kid that he had with any other wife, much less a concubine or a harem member or something like that, was not considered. Just the OG wife, Borte, was considered the one to give offspring that could take his throne. Jochi, the one who wouldn't be able to take his throne and considered, his first son because they didn't know exactly how he was born, became a great military leader. But he was excluded from the line of succession due to the questions surrounding his paternity. Okay? And we're going to get into all the fucking that Genghis Khan did in a minute, but I'm going to just give you a little bit more history. So now, Temujin then aligns himself with one of his father's greatest allies, a guy named Toghrul, who was Khan of the Karaites. and is better known by the Chinese title Wang Kong. That's the best Kong name I've ever seen.
Really cool name.
Yeah.
Technically, Genghis was the Wang Kong.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Everybody Wang Kong tonight. And that essentially began his military political career of establishing alliances to defeat other smaller tribes and expanding what would become the Mongol Empire. And this is the date I said I'm going to mention a couple of times. By 1206, Genghis Khan had managed to unite or subdue the Mirkits, the Naimans, the Karaites, the Tatars, the Uyghurs, and a handful of other smaller tribes. This was a monumental feat and resulted in peace between previously warring tribes and a single political and military force. The union became known as the Mongols. They took the name Mongols. And again, in 1206, at the Kuraldai, a council of Mongol chiefs, Temujin was acknowledged as Khan of the consolidated tribes and took the new title Genghis Khan. According to the secret history of the Mongols, the chieftains of the conquered tribes were all at this Kuraldai, this council of Mongol chiefs, and they had proclaimed their loyalty to him with this. Like, you know when people swear in, like, you know, your Boy Scout, I do solemnly swear, yeah, or whatever the whole... So this is what they said to him. We will make you Khan. You shall ride at our head against our foes. We will throw ourselves like lightning at your enemies. That gets me hard. We will bring you their finest women and girls, their rich tents like palaces. We will throw ourselves like lightning on your enemies.
That's a good one.
Yeah, like, I don't, you know, like, you're not married yet, but like, you know, sickness and in health and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of cool. But if my wife was to tell me, and she probably would, she's a ride or die bitch, that she would throw herself like lightning, and my goddamn enemies, ah, never get divorced. But the one thing that they couldn't pledge to Genghis Khan was freedom from eye strain.
Mm.
But I can do that right now because Felix Gray realized that eyes should not be looking at screens all day. So they designed glasses to make daily screen time more comfortable and the workday more productive. I can't think of a better segue into that than that, right? Felix Gray lenses filters 15 times more blue light than can make screen time tough on your eyes and disruptive to sleep, okay? They're non-prescription glasses and prescription glasses available. Very easy to get. You just got to go to felixgrayglasses.com and use /history so I get a little credit on this goddamn thing. FelixGrayGlasses.com/history. If you look at the glasses I'm wearing right now, they're called the Roblings. That's the design that they have. But they have all the classic frame styles made from acetate and hand finished for a durable, lightweight, and really comfortable pair of glasses. I'm going to tell you, they want you to do like a personal thing. So they offer optical glasses, regular old reading glasses for guys like me and Ken Jack. They offer sunglasses, regular old sunglasses, prescription and non, for guys like me and Ken Jack. They also offer sleep glasses, and I've never seen that before.
What?
An antidote to nighttime blue light exposure. It's clinically proven to increase natural melatonin secretion for better night's sleep. These glasses, because we all read stuff before bed. For some reason, whenever I set my phone, I can't help but then just get one little less fix, right? If I'm wearing these during it, it actually helps increase melatonin. It's sorcery, really, and helps you get a better night's sleep. So the optical glasses, the sunglasses, but also the sleep glasses. And if you want to look as handsome as me, you get the Roblings, okay? Get yourself a pair of glasses made for the 21st century and designed for modern, hardworking eyes. You have nothing to lose except eye strain. Go to felixgrayglasses.com, F-E-L-I-X-G-R-A-Y, glasses.com/history. For the best blue light glasses on the market, felixgrayglasses.com/history. Free shipping, free returns, free exchanges, felixgrayglasses.com/history. Go there now and give your fucking eyes a break. Oof, I cursed. All right, so I keep mentioning 1206, because that's the time where I no longer have to say Temujin. Or Temugin, or whatever the hell we were saying. Yusuji.
Now I get to mispronounce a different word.
Yes, I'm going to mispronounce that Genghis. So by 1206, right, Genghis Khan had successfully consolidated the steppe confederations that we talk about under his banner and then began to turn his attention to outside conquest. And he had to kill a ton of people in the process. So all of the manipulation and the machinations, and I'm trying to think of other Asian words, all the political whatever posturing that he did to create the Mongol Empire with all of those clans, it was relatively friendly. I mean, obviously thousands of eggs were broken, but it was relatively friendly, and they were brought in to create like the beginning of the Mongol Empire. They were the posse. And now they were going to go out and try to conquer the rest of the world, and that got fucking ugly. Mm-hmm. That's where we're going to talk about like genocidal type of violence.
Yes.
Right? Not a good guy, right? Genghis Khan at the end of the day. So Genghis, together with his sons and grandsons, went to war on an immense scale. I thought this was sobering. In only 25 years, the Mongol army conquered more territory than the Romans had done in the previous 400. By the time of his death in 1227, the Mongol Empire stretched from the Pacific Ocean to the Caspian Sea, encompassing over 10 million square miles. The empire was vast, measuring the same size as the African continent. So it was like Africa put on its side and placed into Asia. That's about the size of the Mongol Empire, which is huge. Not only is it the size of Africa, it was larger than the United States, Canada, Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean islands put together. So it was just absolutely huge. And what's more remarkable is he was able to achieve this with only around 100,000 men to start, making Genghis Khan one of the most successful military commanders the world has ever known.
Some of the best ROI you could ever imagine for the amount of troops he had.
Oh, yeah, 100,000 guys, and you get, you know, the second largest empire in the world is crazy.
Xerxes invades Greece with 1 million men, can't even get there.
Yeah, so you see like that guy. So Xerxes from the 300, right?
Yeah.
That guy who gets the spear taken, takes the...
the ring off, the face ring.
Yeah. I love Xerxes' character. I think he's fantastic. I love the 300. The first one was so goddamn good. But, you know, like he's mentioned in all those names, and then I mentioned Alexander the Great, Napoleon, and Genghis Khan. I think that's the end of the list, right? I mean, there isn't a British guy that stands up to this.
There's not a single conqueror. Like, you could put, like, Napoleon on the list because he was able to do it that late. Hitler. You could argue just the Japanese in general. There's different places, like, different, I think, more governments, you can argue, but not so many people. Singular like iconoclasts, people. Or what, not iconoclasts, but like giant icons in history.
I mean, that had like. Is it also like fair to say he did this before modern technology?
Yes.
Where it may have been more, much more.
He was just on horseback. This guy, he had
such
really
a
nothing.
Purist.
I think in a way that it's like, I shouldn't give History Channel a shout out, but didn't they do that one time where they like tried to think of like scenarios that would have happened in history, like a Genghis Khan versus Napoleon.
Right.
It's like, how would the cannons fare against the horses?
I loved that show they did where they put warriors against each other.
That's kind of, I think they did.
Oh, wait, is that World's Deadliest Warrior?
I think so.
That was Spike. That was
Was
that,
it Spike?
That's Spike
was
Network.
That
was a great one.
1920 gangsters against Japanese feudal samurai.
Yes.
And they'd have like the gangsters with the blackjacks, you know, going against the guy who had like the sai and stuff.
Yes.
I thought that was one of the greatest shows ever created.
Dude, that was amazing.
Let's bring back Spike.
I was saying that
it's
before.
It's Paramount.
Well, no, it's FX, right?
And now it's
FX. Is it FX?
FX?
What's Paramount?
I don't know. You're way off.
I think that's what it is. Ink Master. I don't know.
Paramount
is Yellowstone.
Oh.
I think, right?
Nope.
The Paramount Channel, I believe, is what Spike became, and Spike was dissolved after, I forget, but they used to have, like, what was it, the Men Awards or whatever it was?
The
Spike TV Awards.
Yes, yes.
And it would be, like, bustiest babe goes to this person, biggest badass
Didn't
goes to this person.
Didn't they have the Man Show, or was that more network TV?
It might have been them, too. They did, like, 1,000 Ways to Die, too. They did all those shows.
Yeah. 1,000 Ways to Die.
Dude's Rock Shows.
Classic.
All right, so now this is the stat that everybody knows. Khan and his armies wiped out 11% of the world's population. Hmm. They killed 40 million people. So that's the big stat that everyone knows about Genghis Khan. 11% of the world's population was killed by him. It's still a big number, John, even though, right? It's
quite big.
Yeah. 40 million people. I'll give you some perspective. Hitler's Holocaust killed somewhere around 6 million. The largest human catastrophe of Stalinism was the famine of 1930 and 1933, where just over 5 million people died. Genghis Khan's Mongol army killed 40 million people, which is fucking terrible. But also, and I talked about this during the butterfly effect with Jerry, right? We talked about this little thing. Genghis Khan may have been the greatest environmentalist of all time. That's like a little thing that they like to put out. A study by the Carnegie Institute's Department of Global Energy concluded that his 13th century bloody advance may have scrubbed 700 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere. That's roughly the quantity of carbon dioxide generated in a year through global gasoline consumption. I'll say that again. The amount of people he killed scrubbed 700 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere because it was 11% of the world's population. Mm-hmm. And that's equivalent to the amount of carbon dioxide generated in a year through global gasoline consumption. A lot of people use gasoline, myself included. He did it by wiping out whole nations and then allowing those previously populated and cultivated lands to return to carbon-absorbing forests.
Get the trees back, plus a lot of animals let out methane. Like, cows let out a shit ton of methane. It's weird, like, when they put, like, the stats out, like, of how much of just cow management, like, how much of that methane actually contributes towards, like, CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the same thing. It's the same thing even back then.
Yeah. And so so one of the world's greatest environmentalists, and the 40 million doesn't mean that 40 million had died at the edge of his blade, or the Mongol blades. A lot of the places that he had left in his wake were then ravaged by, like, famine and disease and stuff like that.
Ripple effect stuff.
Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily, I mean, some of the places, and we're going to get through them right now, as a matter of fact, were just absolutely, it was barbaric what he had done, but a lot of the other stuff had just, like, collateral damage. Back to death. Here are some of his military highlights. Khan was a brilliant military tactician that loved to fake retreat to draw out his enemies. His soldiers would suddenly appear panicked and turn away. The Mongols would extend their fake retreats for days or weeks to falsely convince the chasers that they were defeated. So when they turn tail and run and you start to chase after them, sometimes you would chase them for weeks thinking, I got them on the run, only to pivot when the enemy was drawn out. So we'd set little traps, destroying them at their leisure. So we'd take you weeks away from a battlefield thinking, all right, we're just going to follow him for a couple more days and we're going to beat him up. These guys are really starting to lose it. And then he'd draw you into some sort of pincer attack and wipe you out.
And the thing is, if you were to turn back and be like, okay, well, they're gone, we're just going to, like, move all the way back, they would then start harassing you with horse archers, like, just peppering you on the whole way back. And one of the most brilliant things that he did was, in his army, he essentially just wasn't a micromanager. So, like, basically in a lot of other armies, like in the Roman army and, like the Alexander's army, it was very much you have to report back to, like, the main head. Like, you have to report back to this guy before you can do any major movements. Mm-hmm. But he was always a guy where he's, like, he'll give his subordinates leeway to do whatever they need to do as long as the grander vision or grander objective is still completed. So if you have to do, like, a little bit of movement without clearing it, do it. If you have to go raid on this flank for this guy, go do it. Right. Do whatever you need to do as long as the main objective you were given is still accomplished.
So there wasn't as much bureaucracy.
Exactly. Yeah, there was less red tape, and he trusted his guys, which is some trust, I think, is a big thing you see throughout him and his just generals in general.
And it seemed like that, too. Like, if you earned his trust, he was one of those guys who everything was more of a meritocracy for him within his armed ranks. But another thing was they were badass soldiers. They were bred for war. At 15, they learned to master how to ride, shoot, and fight without rest or food for days at a clip. They fought in structured, calculated formations. They were unmatched in skill, dedication, loyalty, and strength by any other army. I think this is cool. They can maneuver their horses with just their legs. John, that's impressive.
So they're Navy SEALs.
Yeah, they're the Navy SEALs of the steppes, the steppe SEALs. But they could drive horses with their legs. And the first time you tried to drive your car with your knees and you thought you were the fun, you know, something else. These guys could drive horses with just their legs. That left them hands-free, and they were very adept at shooting bow and arrows, both forward, or they would turn around, still maneuvering the horses with their legs and shooting backwards. I think that would have to be something to see, right? Even in this day and age.
It's awesome.
Right? I don't see that at medieval times. They do everything there.
I'd love to see you attempt that. We'd get you on a horse.
So the archers and his army were able to shoot forward and backward on horseback at full gallop. Genghis Khan invaded China with only 90,000 troops and dominated the largest army in the world. The Jin Dynasty's over 1 million troops. He destroyed over 500,000 of them. So half of the Jin Dynasty's army was killed by 90,000 of Genghis Khan's troops. In the process, he assumed control of northern China and the all-important Beijing. In a battle against the Taijut tribe, Khan was shot off his horse with an arrow. This is kind of what you were talking about, Ken Jack. Mm-hmm. He survived and then later demanded to know which of the prisoners was responsible. Who hit me? Impressed by the prisoner's boldness and skill, he made the man an officer in his army. The prisoner was later given a different name by Khan. He was given the name Jebe, which means arrow, which is kind of cool. And then Jebe went on to become one of Khan's greatest field commanders, right?
Yep, exactly. And that's one of the things. Yeah. Use your greatest enemies as your own asset.
Yeah.
And he became, again, and you'll see that, like him mentioned more as we go along here, he became one of his most trusted generals that, like, he conquered these vast swaths of land. And he's a guy where, like, if this same guy gets captured by a Roman general, he just gets executed on the spot. Like,
right.
But he, like, I feel like Genghis was such a more trusting guy, and he knew when people can be turned to his own advantage.
Right. And I think if you do bring somebody into your fold and you give him a cool name like Arrow.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, so, no, here's even the thing. That it's almost reversed where, like, his name, the name he gave him, Jeb. Or Jebe, I guess.
Jeb, whatever.
So that didn't used to mean arrow. Well, so it became to mean arrow after this guy.
Awesome. Right.
So basically the word came to be because he was so good using bow and arrow troops and bow and arrow
Somewhere
movements.
Out there in history, there was a guy named Nunchuck.
Yeah.
Right, when you think about it.
Exactly.
That, before it. So sometimes when he did do damage, he did damage very well. After seizing all of western Turkestan, Khan ordered the extermination of the entire kingdom of Zizia.
So this is Sisia. That
Sisia,
I know. Yeah.
Because they refused to send troops when he called for them. Destruction and massacre was so complete that Sisia was nearly erased from history. He destroyed paintings and sculptures to try and erase them, just as he did with the masters who created them, to prevent future artwork and from their history being retold. Mm-hmm. That's petty.
Yeah, for
real. It's awesome, yeah.
History's written by the victors, and you can just erase someone from history if you want, especially back then. Not a lot of written records.
He got pissed at the Persian Khwarizmid. So a Khwarizmian and Khwarizmid. So the Persian Empire, Khwarizmid, offended Genghis Khan when they beheaded one of his messengers and then looted one of Genghis's caravans, trade caravans. The insult led to a huge Mongol invasion of 200,000 men that went to wipe out the Khwarizmian Empire. The war lasted for 3 years, from 1218 to 1221. No living thing was spared, not even the animals. Skulls of the dead were piled in a large pyramid. His war with the Khwarizmian Empire resulted in casualties that amounted to 3/4 of modern-day Iran's population. Here's another part of that same thing. When he destroyed the Afghan city of Herat in 1221, near the end of this Persian war, there were reportedly only 9 survivors of the city's population of 400,000. Sufficient.
He was pretty pissed off, and it's almost like they came into town, and like he only sent them these messengers and saying, like, hey, we want to do some trade with you. We're new in town. Here's a pie. Here's a trade caravan. Right. We want to just do trade with you. We're establishing these networks with our neighboring empires, and they were just like, that emperor was just like, hey, fuck you, and just killed all of these guys, looted them.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then this became like literally a 3-year dismantling of this man's entire existence. And like you're saying right now, like this is basically the new Persian Empire at this point. And like it's people don't even know how to pronounce it because they're so irrelevant because Genghis Khan erased them.
I should have just said Persians because I butchered that worse than anything else in the thing. But I will tell you that it wasn't always the case. So I'm going to talk about 11% of the population. Do you want to give a little pause here?
That's just a brutal just one. Sorry.
Very loud siren. Yeah.
I could just see it coming down 7th Avenue.
Yeah. I think it adds a grittiness.
Yeah.
To the thing. Yeah. producer's worst nightmare.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. But I will say, even though like we're talking about 40 million dead, 11% of the population, as he's going along what essentially became the Silk Road, there were a lot of empires or towns or villages that were down.
Mm-hmm.
Like he'd send a messenger and he'd be like, listen, we're the new kids in town. We're going to do this, 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 and this. And they were like, cool, we're in. He didn't have to kill everybody, but he did kill a shitload of people. After obliterating that Persian empire whose name escapes me, Genghis Khan took half of his army and headed back to Mongolia, but not without conquering northern India on its way. It's a big feat. And the second half of his army split into 2 divisions and then went into Russia.
And this is one of my favorites. Yeah. This is where my guy Subutai comes into play.
Tell me about him. I don't know Subutai.
Okay. Yeah. So Subutai was a guy, he basically used to be, he'd be like a tent guard for Genghis's, like all of his war meetings and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy that he listened in on these, he learned strategy, tactician, like just like everything he needed to know about being a general in Genghis's army, gets eventually promoted away through his ranks, so he becomes a general. And after they destroy this Persian empire, Jebe, who we talked about before, and right. Subate, they go on this big recon mission, which they later like start to call the Great Raid. And like it's essentially they want to just like basically they have 20,000 troops. They want to just go through all the Caucasus and the Russian areas and raid everything, loot everything. It's not meant to conquer anything. It's essentially just force recon,
right?
More or less. And so they go. The first place they go is into Georgia, and not. For those of you listening, we're not talking like here. We're talking about Georgia, closer to where
modern day country of Georgia, that same area.
Yes.
Russia.
They never made it to Atlanta.
Yes. I can tell you that. So the Georgians, they send a 30,000 man empire to go meet them in battle. This is the 20,000 roughly Mongolian troops. And these 30,000 troops the Georgians send all get destroyed. And they're all meant to fight in the Crusades. They were being sent on the Fifth Crusade. And because they never made it, they essentially just impacted all of the waves of the Fifth Crusade because those 30,000 troops might have completely changed the course of that crusade as well. So they go into Russia, and when they get through Georgia and like into the actual areas of like the Rus Empire at that point, the Russians, they band together, and they have like essentially an 80,000 large army. And the Mongols have around – it's still like 20,000 at this point. And they basically – Subate, he has this idea. He's like, we don't have enough troops to beat these guys in head-on battle. They have a lot of armored knights. Armored knights is not something they really had like a counter for necessarily because like they're mostly lighter cavalry, lighter troops. They're meant to like harass and move fast and move all –
jumping backwards on a horse.
Yeah. They're not meant
– shooting an arrow, John.
Not meant to be like in a pitched like head-to-head battle like that. Right. So he leaves behind 1,000 troops. And he tells like the guy in charge of them, he's like, look, just report their movements, tell me what happens. The Russians move in on them really fast, destroy these guys, and think like, oh, the Mongols are routing. The same sort of like thing we're talking about before, the feigned retreat. So they chase the Mongols for 9 days all the way back to this place called the Kalka River. And the Kalka River, the Mongols basically, as they're crossing, they sweep in and attack them and destroy the entire Russian army down to a man. Crush them. And this is going to go into, I think, your next point, too.
Yeah.
But Subate, he essentially, like I said before, is part of the Genghis Khan, I was going to say Hitler Youth. That's probably a bad example.
He's
part
of
his Boy Scout program, kind of. But by the time he passes, dude, he conquers cities in China, Russia, India, Eastern Europe, Central Asia. And the maneuvers that he uses were studied by guys like Rommel, like guys like Patton. The Desert Fox. And it was, remember Patton yelling, I read your book, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
They read Subate's book.
Right.
And a lot of his doctrine that he did, because Subate was such an innovative general, was used later on in modern fighting. Like, he had this idea of using, like, artillery and weapons traditionally used for siege in conventional battles and using them to like attack or use them to like bombard a group of enemies right before an infantry wave comes in or right before a cavalry wave comes in to attack you. And that gets
artillery essentially.
Literally, yeah. And so that later gets used in the creeping assault doctrine, which is used in World War I because they would soften you up with artillery, then charge with infantry. So
you know what he used to do too? And one of the only little things that I know, and obviously this is battlefields, right? It's not drone fighting or anything. It's these traditional battlefields where people would be camped out for days before they would actually do actual battle, and you'd be miles away from each other, but you kind of see the encampments from miles away. He would make every one of his soldiers every night light 5 fires so that way when the people that they were fighting would look across to the enemy encampment, they would see 5 times as many fires and think they had 5 times as many men
troops,
over there.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It was all that kind of weird shit that you kind of take for granted.
Mind games.
He's big on psychological warfare. Even when he attacked the Georgians, he basically got one city to open gates by having a bunch of guys build crosses, and he had the guys parade crosses in front of the city just to make them think that they were like a rescuing or relieving Christian army.
Right.
So they open up the gates and then swarm a bunch of Mongols and just kill everybody.
They had this thing, so he defeated a Russian army 4 times the size of this. Like you're saying, their surviving leaders, including Prince Romanovich of Kiev, surrendered to them, understanding, you had to promise me that no blood will be shed. So the Mongols, Subate and Hebei, said, no problem, no blood will be shed. So instead, these leaders, including Prince Romanovich of Kiev, were tied up and laid flat, where they became the foundation for a heavy wooden platform in which the Mongol commanders danced and feasted upon before choosing which Russian women to bed, while the prince and his allies were either crushed or suffocated, mm-hmm. technically not spilling blood.
They were big on crushing people, the Mongols. They love that.
So we're not going to spill blood, but we're going to put you under a makeshift dance floor that we're going to pick out your women and stuff like that and party.
We're going to do the electric slide while we decide which one of your women we're going to take.
Essentially suffocate you. The Mongols slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Russian peasants also, and it took centuries for Russia to finally recover. I'm going to go to this line because I love it, but I will mm-hmm. tell you, I never wrote this down. Russia had control of Mongolia for a while. Like Mongolia's storied history, it was under Russian rule for a while. And when it was under Russian rule, it is no longer, all images and mentions of Genghis Khan were strictly outlawed. Mm-hmm. Everything was taken down, and now that's not the case. Obviously, I think Genghis Khan is on Mongolian money. Mm-hmm. Right, and he certainly had a lot of bags of barbecue.
Have you ever seen the Genghis Khan statue?
The statue's awesome.
It's one of the coolest things ever made.
Yeah, and he was basically, you know, a guy who killed 40 million people.
He's 40 killed what 40 million people, and they have a statue like the size of the Statue of Liberty, just sitting in the middle of Mongolia awesome. Of
it's
Genghis
silver.
Khan.
Yeah. And I think Coley wrote something. When will he be Genghis canceled? Like, you know, something like that. It seems like so the famous line from Conan the Barbarian. So I had to do something with you assholes. On Lights, Camera, Barstool, mm-hmm. where I had to rank a bunch of movies and stuff. And Conan the Barbarian is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh, yeah.
And,
me too.
And I think it was one of those things where you had some sympathy for it because of a nostalgia reason. And even though I'm much older than you, it just really hits me in the feels every time that I watch it. But one of the greatest lines from that is when Conan is learning to be a warrior, they ask him, what in life is truly good? Or what is the meaning of life? And Conan says, to crush your enemies and see them driven before you and hear the lamentations of the women. Like, that's a famous line. It's mm-hmm. not a bad Arnold either. That was bastardized from this Genghis Khan quote. The greatest pleasure is to vanquish your enemies and chase them before you. Very, very similar to crush your enemies and see them driven before you. To rob them of their wealth and see those dear to them bathed in tears. To ride their horses and clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters. I mean, so those are two very good quotes.
Yeah.
I like them a lot. That if you're ever going to pledge allegiance to me, and please, at some point, if you tell me that you will throw yourself like lightning at my enemies, you're in. You're down with whatever posse I'm trying to put together. And then, you know, conversely, if you were to go like Arnold on me and say the greatest pleasure is to vanquish your enemies and chase them before you, to rob them of their wealth, and see those dear to them bathed in tears, to ride their horses and clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters. That's awesome. So speaking of clasping to bosoms, wives and daughters, I said we were going to talk a little bit about sex, and we're going to do that now. But first, the return to travel is finally here, and everybody wants to look as sexy as Genghis Khan. That's a little ham-handed, but it is what it is. We talk about bare-bottom clothing a couple of times on this show. They're one of our recurring sponsors. Vibs wears it all the time. My son, Vibs actually wore it exclusively on that goddamn bus thing that they do in Barstool versus America, which I think drops at the end of this week, so stay tuned for that. Mm-hmm. So he wears this bare-bottom clothing thing. My son wears it. He's 17 years old, handsome as all get out. His friends wear it. They had sent me a bathing suit that my balls don't fall out of, so that's a huge recommendation for me. Bare-bottom clothing does things differently. It was founded on the principle that comfortable, made-to-last menswear shouldn't cost you an arm and a leg. Their 5-star rated shorts, swim trunks, and tees have gained a cult-like following of thousands of guys who made bare-bottom the MVP of their closets. I wear the bathing suits. I look good in it. Vibs wears their stuff. He looks good in it. My 17-year-old son wears his stuff. He looks good in it. That's 3 generations saying that they like bare-bottom. I don't think you're going to get that in other podcasts, to be quite honest with you. Right now, our listeners get free shipping with their first order of these super comfortable threads at barebottomclothing.com with the code TWISTED. Just go to barebottomclothing.com, and that's bear, B-E-A-R, like the animal, clothing.com, and use TWISTED to get free shipping on your first order. Go there now and look good. But we were talking about sex, right? We were talking about hot, electric Genghis Khan sex. When he was not busy subjugating nations across Asia, he spent his time with women. He had 6 wives and around 500 concubines. It's a big number. I like this. So out of those 6 wives, Borte was number one with the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
His first was his greatest, and like I said, the children that he had with Borte were the only ones who were eligible to take over for him after he had died. So the other six wives were also all given, like, lands, all given control of, like, armies and stuff. Like, he was very, very progressive as far as that went. But one of his wives, he abducted her. Good-looking chick, from what I understand. But she had said to him, listen, I'm fine and all that stuff. My sister is gorgeous. So I'll marry you, but I'm telling you, you should marry my sister also. And he complied. He went and he, like, looked at the sister. And he's like, wow, you're right. She's actually better than you. So he married both of them. So he had six wives and 500 concubines. This is another popular type of stat. I think when we were talking, Ken Jack, about doing this podcast, we said the three things that everyone knows about Genghis Khan. A lot of people know about how many people he killed.
Yes.
A lot of people know about how many people he's banged.
Yes.
And a lot of people know, like, some of the stuff surrounding his death.
Yeah.
Like his burial and stuff like that. So this is the second part of what a lot of people may know. Geneticists estimate that 16 million males, which is 0.5%, a half a percent of the Earth's male population, are genetically linked to Genghis Khan. 16 million males are genetically linked to Genghis Khan. He fathered hundreds of children during his lifetime. He's considered the most successful biological father in human history. And one in 200 men alive today is a relative of Genghis Khan. Mm-hmm. So, one of the greatest military minds in history. He's also one of the biggest environmentalists in the history of the world. And he's also the most successful biological father in human history.
He's essentially like a real-life Adam, more or less.
Yeah.
Like, he's like the true genetic father of so many people that are still alive today, which is insane. There's so many people that are alive today, rather.
One in 200 men alive today. And it's not a dated stat, and the stat's a couple years old, but one in 200 men alive today is a distant relative of Genghis Khan. I mean, that's, you know, those three things that I just mentioned, to put those on a resume, oof.
For real.
Good for him. His son Toshi had 40 sons. That's a lot. I have three kids. I'm overwhelmed. Genghis's grandson, who we spoke about a little bit before, Kublai Khan, is known for hosting Marco Polo. Kenjack knows about him. He had 22 legitimate sons from his four legally wedded wives. So he had 22 legit sons from his four wives. But he maintained 7,000 concubines.
Mm-hmm.
He had 7,000
women. One for every day of the life.
Yeah.
Literally.
He's 7,000 women in his harem.
I mean, there's no chance that he slept with every single one of his concubines. Like,
but he was like at home. And by the way, so Kublai Khan, you had mentioned that you know a lot about him. He was me. He drank a lot.
This sure did.
I think he died of complications from gout.
He definitely had really bad gout, yeah.
Really bad gout. Guy was kind of a slob. He had 7,000 women in his harem. I like him. I think that he should get a little bit more shine. He's got a better name, too. Kublai, you say?
Kublai Khan. Alliteration always plays.
Yeah. KK. Yeah, that's a good one.
We're going to keep Ken Jack around for pronunciation.
Yeah, I think he's good.
Trust me, I'm never the person you're going to want for pronunciations on almost anything.
And now I got a tough one coming up. Babur, the founder of the Mughal Empire in India, I think I got that one, was also the direct descendant of Genghis Khan. He had six wives and 18 children.
Mughal Empire was huge, too.
The Mughal?
It basically almost encompassed all of India, parts of like Afghanistan, the Middle East. It was
huge. Yeah, and I said, like, when they got done with the that Persian War, they kind of sent people up, you know, two armies up into Russia and the rest back to Mongolia. And I casually mentioned how he took most of India. That was huge, too.
Mm-hmm.
He took all, like, Afghanistan, all these modern-day countries it blows my mind on how easily everything just kind of went. How did he choose his women? That's what I was making the point. First off, he loved to sleep with the wives and daughters of defeated enemy rulers. There's nothing that kind of makes you feel better after defeating somebody than sleeping with their wives and their daughters if they're of age, right? But he also had these victory feasts where he would see these captive girls paraded before him and he would rate them, sort of like an early Facebook, right? Khan would take the highest ranked. He liked women particularly with small noses, rounded hips, rosy lips, long hair, and beautiful voices. Who doesn't, right? He measured women with points, I believe sort of like carrots. He may even call them carrots. If a woman's score was too low, he gave her to his lieutenants. And if a woman was very high on his scale, with the small noses, round hips, rosy lips, long hair, small waist, pretty face with a big bank. He kept them for himself. So that's all I'm going to say about him having sex, but that's it. You were about to say something?
I was just about to say he was the original Tinder, you know, algorithm.
More or less. Tell you what, it would really suck to be a woman conquered in the Mongol Empire. Yeah. It would really, really suck. Bad for a guy, too, because you most likely are just going to get killed, but it's a tough life.
He didn't allow any paintings or sculptures of himself to be made while he was alive. It was another thing, like, with Confucius. It was another thing with, like, I think Attila. I think a lot of people, even though Confucius is not in the same conversation, but I'd mentioned a similar stat about him. So what Genghis Khan looked like is kind of a mystery. There's some really accepted paintings of him, but none of them were made real time.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff that we're looking at was made generations after he had died. So even though there's some long red hair and green eyes, like Mao Lin from Big Trouble in Little China, there's also been, like, you know, gray hair, blue eyes, that whole thing. So we really don't know what he looked like, but we did know what type of women he liked to bed. There are some positives to talk about with Genghis Khan after we talk about killing 40 million people and all that kind of stuff. Many historians consider Genghis Khan a ruthless killer and a merciless tyrant, but others praise him as the founding father of Mongolia and a supporter of religious tolerance. That seems to be the first thing that people put up there. He was extremely religious. He gave religious freedom to conquered lands and offered tax exemptions to places of worship, which was huge.
Yeah. Right? I think that's one of the bigger reasons why so many countries and everything, like these smaller groups, would like just kowtow. They're like, we're not going to make us assimilate into your empire. You're going to let us essentially like do our own thing. You're not going to forcibly make us follow your religion or your culture or anything like that. We can essentially keep our identity in a sense while being part of like this bureaucratic and massive empire.
Seems like an easy game.
Yeah.
Because I can tell you the Vikings didn't do that when they raided England.
No, they sure didn't.
Yeah, so I mean they were burning everything and melting down crosses and you know, I mean some of them adopted Christianity at some point, but this is one of those things where it almost seemed like an easy decision.
Yeah.
You know, I'm coming in with these guys who could, I know, again, I'm very, very impressed with this. They could shoot backwards on a horse. Like, I'd rather just be like, all right, cool. Like, still go to church on Sunday?
Just own it. It's fine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, probably do better from you. He didn't believe in persecuting somebody for their faith. He was very spiritual, would pray for days ahead of making big decisions. He would seek other religious leaders to understand their faith as well. He used to throw, like, parties where he'd get together leaders of different faiths, and they would have, like, intelligent discussions, but the intelligent discussions were centered around booze. So they'd go on, like, these benders, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they would kind of come up with answers or even more problems. Within a few decades of the Magna Carta being put in place in England, Genghis Khan implemented a very similar document into law called the Yasa. This was like his rule of law, which prohibited things such as adultery, theft, and lying, and it also promoted religious tolerance. So he kind of did lay down the law, left like a book of laws behind. He also supported ethnic diversity within his empire, allowing people from other cultures to administer his cities. I wrote this in there primarily because many Mongols were illiterate morons, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like they could go in, take over a city that was more advanced, technologically astute or something than him, and expect to have, you know, Joe Mongol, you know, run the latest blockbuster. So they allowed these people from different cultures to maintain positions of power, which in this day and age comes across as him supporting ethnic diversity. Whatever. I got to put that in there for the guy.
They were like double incentivized because for those guys, it means like, hey, I can maintain a position of power within this like, let's say you live in City A. It gets conquered by the Mongols. Instead of you now being thrown out on the street for Joe Mongol, you can maintain your position of power in this bureaucracy. And at the same time, like, you know, you're making money, you're doing all this. For the Mongols, you're now getting more tax money because, again, Joe Mongol has no idea how to administer this city. He has no idea the ins and outs. He has no idea the trade. Like everything is so unique and so different, especially at this point in history. So like they were so much more efficient in making this work for them because, you know, again, by the end of the day, your random guy in City A is loving this because he gets to maintain his spot, and the Mongols are getting more money, more trade, more everything.
Right.
It's perfect for them.
And developing the Silk Road, which is one of the other things that he's given. And the Silk Road might be an episode in itself. He's credited with bringing the Silk Road under one cohesive political environment. This brought easier communication and trade between Northeast Asia, Muslim Southwest Asia, Christian Europe, expanding the cultural horizons of all three areas. He started the first post office for all intents and purposes. He had something like this called the Yam. This is simply called the Yam. It's like the first Pony Express which ran up and down the Silk Road, which, I mean, people hear the word Silk Road a lot. I think I'm going to dedicate something to it because Marco Polo, Kublai Khan, Silk Road, I mean, I can't do it next week, obviously, because it's too, you know, repetitive. But that's one of those things where you see these type of, you know, Panama Canal-ish type things, which revolutionized the way that people did trade. And so Genghis Khan was at the forefront of creating that. So he's, you know, it doesn't take away the 40 million deaths, but it is what it is.
Didn't I wanted to bring up, because you we already brought up Hitler in World War II and some of these comparisons. I don't quite know the same reasons, but didn't after they invaded Poland, didn't they put some of those men into the German army, into the Nazi army, right? I don't know if it was for the same reasons as, like, you know, needing more men, but I believe they did put, because there's that great scene in Saving Private Ryan where those
two guys Polish troops
are putting their hands up and they're actually saying we're Polish, we're not we're not German.
They forcibly conscripted a lot. I think like they had like a lot of Czech soldiers, like in some other countries they just kind of like gave them, like the Romanians I think believe just gave the Germans a bunch of troops, like some, I think it depended country to country, but there was definitely a lot of sympathizers that would just like sign up, like the Finns I think did that in some other countries,
or even guys like I was going to say who were just forced and were definitely probably not thrilled. You know, we're not thinking along the same lines as like, oh well, I could keep my political, you know, none of that. It was more just like,
but multiple benefits, I mean, as far as language and, you know, knowing the cultures and stuff like that, on top of having bodies you know, on it. So I'm sure there's a bunch of Shanghaiing around there. I'm going to talk to you guys real quick about this guy, Will, who sent me a DM. He said, number one, my fiance and I just drove 11 and a half hours round trip from New York to North Carolina. And I listened to Twisted History with her exclusively the whole way. Listen to 12 hours of Twisted History. He's like, I love the shit out of Vibs. And listening to you and St. Anne's go back and forth reassures us, him and his young wife, that we made the right choice with each other because we have the same lighthearted banter. So thank you for making what could have been a miserable drive enjoyable. No mention of John. Imagine that. Number two, I got three chi and I love that shit. This is the same DM. That's why I mentioned it. He's like, I smoked a lot of weed in younger years. Fucked me up. But this stuff is nice. He's like, my mom was typically a drinker. It gets a little more granular, but I'll just say his mom is typically a drinker. But he put her on 3-Chi, and she raised about this shit also. So there's no better way to talk about 3-Chi. He said, bottom line, I love your content. Your wife is a badass bitch, and you have some awesome sponsors. I agree. 3-Chi, pronounced 3-Chi, which we all know, is the industry leader in Delta-8 THC products. There's CBD, which doesn't do much. Then there's full-blown weed, which does too much for me. And right in the middle, leaning a little bit towards the weed side, is Delta 8. 3-Chi formulated by a biochemist who was on the show once in the Twisted History of Weed. It's made in the USA with USA-grown hemp. Gives an amazing buzz, great body feel with a clearer head. So I eat the gummies. I eat the cookies. I eat the Rice Krispie treats, which they have to call cereal treats. And I love the goddamn brownies.
Oh, the brownies are the best. They unbelievable.
Do such a good job with those things.
And they're vacuum sealed so they don't like lose any of that freshness.
I take them on planes.
Yeah.
I've never been caught. Not caught. I've never been hassled.
It's legal. You don't even have
to
be. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's so goddamn easy. The brownies are 50 milligrams, which I normally don't do. But with an ice cold glass of milk, you tell me you can stop halfway. I can't stop halfway.
Definitely not me.
Yeah, yeah. So 3chi.com, and you're looking for Delta 8 products. The edibles, like I just talked about, the gummies and the baked goods. You can get tinctures and vapes and oils and all that kind of stuff, all at 3chi.com. That's the number 3chi.com. When you go there, load up and use the code TWISTED2021 at checkout to receive a measly 5% off your order. TWISTED2021 at checkout to receive 5% off your order, which is better than nothing because this stuff is very good. 3chi.com, the number 3chi.com, and use the code TWISTED2021 to get 5% off your order. I can't talk more strongly, but I think it's one of the best things that's been put into this company in a long time. You use it. Yeah. I mean, obviously,
all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I love this one. And by the way, whenever MB has it, MB runs a lot of the stuff, she can't even keep it in her desk.
No, people just come by and take it because they love it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I said I need it.
I literally need it to make ads.
Yeah,
and it's
I just
like
want
it's
to
all
see
gone.
What it's like,
yeah.
So I'm not like an idiot. So finally I got some. All right, let's get into the end of it. We're starting to wrap up here a little bit, guys, and we're going to talk about Genghis Khan's death. He died sometime during the fall of Yinchuan. I did okay with that?
That sounds good, yeah.
Okay. It's unclear if he was killed in battle, if he died of an illness or some sort of accident. The most contemporaneous source available, The Secret History of the Mongols, claims that he fell from his saddle while hunting and then later died of his injuries, which is boring. Since The Secret History was commissioned by the Mongol royal family, it's hard to know if this is true. Marco Polo, who we mentioned was friendly with his Genghis's grandson, Kublai, claimed that Genghis Khan was killed after an arrow wound became infected. That's a little bit better. Some reports he bled out after being castrated by a Chinese princess.
Yeah, that one would never fly.
No, I know, but I like that one a lot. Regardless, he died in August of 1227 at about 65 years of age. He had 40 virgins and 40 horses buried with him for the afterlife, along with a shit ton of gold. So I like you glance over that, but it's so weird to know that 40 virgins and 40 horses were buried alive with them, right? Along with a shit ton of gold. It's believed that Khan's tomb is located on a peak in the Khenti Mountains, but has never been discovered because every one of the 2,000 people, now I wrote down 2,000. Some people say this number is as much as 70,000. I can't believe that though. So I'll take the 2,000. And this is that third type of thing everybody knows. Every one of the 2,000 people who attended Genghis Khan's funeral was reportedly massacred by 800 soldiers. So if you went to his funeral, you were killed. That way you weren't able to tell people where he was buried. The 800 soldiers who killed you were in turn killed by a group of traveling escorts, hired guns. So if you're a soldier that killed the 2,000 people, you were also killed. And then the escorts were sworn and they all committed suicide, which erases any trace of where this grave would be so it would never be found. Okay? According to legend, Khan requested that a river be diverted over his grave so he would not be disturbed. That follows a custom of burial that started with Gilgamesh and also Attila the Hun. So not only can they not find, it might be because he's buried underneath the bed of a formerly diverted river. Khan's tomb is also said to be cursed, and if it is opened, a great war will follow. But we don't give a shit. Modern technology, satellite imagery, thermographs, all that stuff is being used right now to find it because they want to get all that gold, but it hasn't been successful yet. We can't find where this son of a bitch is buried.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite, I think, just not even death stories, but just the one of the coolest stories in history ever.
Yeah.
Just this entire death saga. Legend or not, it's just an interesting story.
The funeral procession, if you came across somebody on the road as you were proceeding to the funeral, they killed you on the road. Right? They were totally covering the tracks here, John. They don't want you to know where he was buried. And then so finally, this is something that we had mentioned. World War I and World War II were responsible for the contraction of the British Empire. Biggest empire, non-contiguous in the history of the world. But what caused the Mongolian Empire to contract? The Mongol Empire that was developed by Genghis Khan wound up ruling large parts of modern-day China, Mongolia, obviously, Russia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Moldova, South Korea, North Korea, and Kuwait. That's the breadth. That's the scope of this. What the fuck happened to it, right? After the reign of Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan, came to an end in 1294, fellow gout sufferer, as we had said. One big reason the Mongol Empire fell was due to a lack of system for transition of powers. As one local ruler died, there was no set rules to name a successor. And it had that loosey-goosey type thing where you can keep your religion, you can keep your tax collectors. Yep. So all of a sudden, it became fragmented under different leaders. So death wasn't handled that well within the Mongol Empire. So that's the worst thing that can happen to an empire that doesn't handle death well. I would think it would be a plague. In 1346, a little thing called the Black Death occurred, and it grew to become the most fatal pandemic recorded in human history, causing the death of anywhere between 75 and 200 million people. Drive a truck through that, but somewhere between 75 and 200 million people were killed by the Black Plague, the Black Death, in Eurasia and North Africa, and a lot of that was in the lands that consisted that the Mongol Empire had owned at the time. Yeah. So they didn't do well with the transition of power because of deaths. And then they had the greatest plague to ever kill people in the history of the world hit them, caused too many deaths. And as that happened, all these things fragmented and started up as smaller empires and eventually smaller countries themselves.
Yeah, they split up into the Khanates, and the Khanates all basically, like, they're all like their own little sub-empires.
Yeah, Khanates, yeah.
And they all, like, kind of did their own thing. Like, some of them reverted back to the old, like, the older ways. They remained, like, the more loyal to the nomadic heritage of the Mongols. Some adapted, became, like, dynasties in China. Some adapted, became, like, more Southeast Asian empires. They all did their own thing. Not all of them kept that same sort of, like, the bureaucratic nature that the Mongols had set up of, like you were saying before, you know, instead of Joe Mongol handling everything, you know, you integrate your local guys into everything. Some of them are saying, you know, no more religious tolerance in our Khanate. Now we want everyone to follow this religion. No more this in ours. They all did their own thing. They had, like, a loose sort of alliance with each other, but it all just sort of fell apart in the end. And like you're saying, the fucking bubonic plague spread along trade routes, and the biggest trade route in the entire fucking universe at that point was, in fact, the Silk Road. So did not help them out at all.
You think we're worse off that the Mongol Empire doesn't exist as it existed at one time? You think we're worse off having Afghanistan, Turkmenistan? I'm not picking on the Afghans. I apologize. It's just something that, you know, you think we're worse off not having... You know,
because they used to be part of the Mongol Empire. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you think like the Mongol Empire existing today with just better hats? Right. I mean, it could do with those silly fucking hats. But, you know, it's one of those things where because there's so much political and, you know, strife between these every one of those countries that I just, you know, rattled off. It's impossible to maintain that empire is the answer, I'm assuming.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever watched like Star Trek before, how they have like all of Earth becomes united behind this one cause, and like all cultures and everything, all that identity remains the same. Like that is like the idyllic version of the Mongol Empire. So like if that existed today where like all of the planet was under one banner, but all of the subgroups and subcultures were allowed to retain that cultural identity, like wouldn't that be cool, right? Earth as a nation instead of like as a separated thing. But, like, it's just not a thing humans, I think, would ever really get behind.
And he certainly wouldn't have stopped at the Caspian Sea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it'd be Irish Mongols. That just doesn't make any sense, right? Speaking of Irish Mongols, I want to thank Jack Kennedy and Mike McCarthy and John Kelly for hosting this edition of Twisted History. I want to thank St. Anne for doing all the research, as she does as always. And I will repay her the way Genghis would repay one of his 500 concubines a little later on tonight. But that was it. That was Twisted History of Genghis Khan. Jack, what do you need to promote anything?
Just Lights, Camera, Barstool. Anytime you want to look at it, make sure you want to go. If you want good interviews with some big time Hollywood studs, go to the Lights, Camera, Barstool YouTube. I'm interviewing people all the time, so check them out.
Yeah, you guys never stopped, and you're still going through. You're doing premieres. You're doing the premiere of Suicide Squad tonight.
Got Suicide Squad tonight, so that's gonna be fun. I'll report back with my findings. Actually, you know what? I definitely won't. There's definitely a big social embargo, so you don't have to wait.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because you've been sitting on some stuff for over a year.
Yeah. Well, that only just came out. Quiet Place Part 2.
Yes. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
I'd seen that in March of 2020. That movie got delayed for over a full year, 18 months, I think, or 14 months. And so I wasn't allowed to talk about it for 14 months at all.
It's wild. Yeah. So Lights, Camera, Barstool. I've been on it a couple of times. It's longer than this. These guys do like these 3-hour marathons. They start taping like 7 o'clock at night. Crazy.
Ken Jack's big movie guy. We were just at Willie Colon's party.
Yes.
And he gave me a recommendation of Lupin, which is a new Netflix show. And I had watched the trailer before, and I was like, I'm not going to see that. But he gave me the recommendation. I'm already hooked. I'm already addicted. Mm-hmm. Watched like
good heist show
season.
I love it. Yeah.
Oh, you watched?
Oh yeah, yeah. Wow. So I'm into the second season. The second season just dropped. So I'm into the second. We can't talk about it, like about anything. But yeah, I liked it a lot. I think he's very, very likable. There's a couple of good characters.
A lot of charm.
Yeah. There's some good stuff. Poor man's Idris Elba.
Yes.
But that's it. So Ken Jack, you can come back anytime, and because we'd love to have you. And thank you everybody for watching at Twisted History and all the social. Buy some shit in the store if you have any extra money. Support all our sponsors, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.